And we'll do a work session on 625, Senate Bill 625.
You want to move dash one amendments? Because we have a dash one amendments, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you should have a dash one amendments to 625, as well as a hand engrossed bill that had no one prepared for the committee. 625 is a bill that was was sponsored by Senator Hannan that we heard testimony on. This is the personal privacy, an invasion of personal privacy bill. We had talked when this was before the committee for public hearing about some of the problems with applying this for a person, as you recall, who is not recording a person who is nude in a place of reasonable expectation of personal privacy, but rather where a person is there to observe the person. I sent this down to legislative counsel with notes regarding amendments from our conversations in the committee, and counsel at legislative counsel made the amendments that are on line 12, so that I think the key change there is that on line 13, it says the person is in a location to observe another person in a state of nudity without the consent of the other person. Legislative counsel believed that this would include a person who's there physically or a person who puts a camera in a situation like that. And then the other change is on line 26 of the Hannan Grost Amendment. One of the issues that was brought up was that a locker room, we added the word enclosed so that it would only apply in a locker room that includes an enclosed area for dressing or showering, so that we're not dealing with a situation where someone sees a person who's nude. That's not we don't want this to be applied to someone who sees a person nude coincidentally, but it now would apply to a person who is in a location to observe another person in a state of nudity without the consent of the other person.
All right, and I think one of the questions that Senator Courtney raised when this bill was here before was the nudist camp issue. Mm-hmm. How does this apply to, I guess, an encampment where people choose to run around in their birthday suits?
Well, the first issue you'd have to work out is whether they were consenting to have other people see them nude. That would be one issue. The other issue is there a reasonable expectation of personal privacy at a nudist colony? I don't believe there would be. If you look at the definition on line 25 of the Hannan-Grost Amendments. And thirdly, I would hope that a district attorney would use discretion and not apply this in such a case.
I'm going to move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 625.
Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 625. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move 625 as amended to follow the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 625 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I haven't discussed this bill, but a member of my press is here, so I'm not going to say what I'm thinking about. This bill probably is going to prove very interesting in terms of people that are living together.
Okay. Does that mean you don't want to carry the bill?
I think this bill should be carried by the co-chair of Ways and Means, Senator Lynn Hannan from Ashland.
All right. Any further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Duncan, if Senator Hannan doesn't want to carry this, would you? We'll ask
Senator
Hannan. Don't
know too much about the bill.
All right. Next up, Senate Bill 661.
Public hearing. Emilio DeBess, is that correct?
You're first up, sir.
Which bill? 661.
Six-six-one. Oh.
Everyday life.
Okay.
You're like me, dyslexic here. You back to find out.
Karen and Kathy.
So you're both, are you both against it?
661?
Why?
It's a juvenile rights project.
I don't know why, but I have a feeling you know why.
661?
661. Kathy, how are you today?
Just fine, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Where's your suitcase?
It's downstairs in the lobby message center. I do have my computer in the back of the room. For the record, Your Honor, Mr. Chair, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is, I signed up in opposition to Senate Bill 661. I think our concern is that 661 is overbroad in how it's written. And on all the sections that's adding to the adult statutes, which would be page 2, lines 30 through 34, page 4, lines 7 through 11, and also on page 4, 28 through 31. When you look at the definition of sex offender in ORS 181-594, juveniles are already included within that definition. So when you use that definition in each one of these sections, essentially what it would mean is that the Department of Corrections or Community Corrections would have to notify on the juvenile offenders the and also the chairperson of the State Board of Parole and Probation would also have to notify. I don't think that was the intent, but that's what the law is saying here. They would essentially have that legal duty even though they wouldn't know about the youth offenders that are going out. To switch that, what you could do is say a person who is convicted of a sex crime as defined in ORS 181-594. That would cover the juveniles that are convicted of a Measure 11 crime or are waived and convicted in adult court, which those departments would then have notice of those individuals being released. But would not cover the juveniles who are adjudicated in juvenile court, which the way it's written, those juveniles are caught up in that. Now getting to about the notification on the youth offenders, which is on page 5 of the bill. Right now, the Oregon Youth Authority has an obligation to notify the law enforcement agencies in the community when the youth offender is coming out of a youth correction facility, it back into the community, and notify the school district. And that notification has to include their name, their release date, the type of placement they're going to be released to, and whether school attendance is a condition of that release. That's appropriate because the law enforcement agencies need to know who's in their area, and also the schools need to know who's coming into their district. In terms of notifying about the conditions of release, however, the way this is written, OIA would not only have to notify law enforcement of the conditions of release, but also the school district of the conditions of release. When you're talking about juveniles, conditions of release can include some information that we might want to keep rather confidential. In other words, information about mental health treatment, information about other aspects of the family that because a court can order that the family do certain things in order for the child to be able to come back to their home. So you're talking about some information that perhaps families would not want to be out in more of a public record than it already is to the school districts and to law enforcement. Since they already have to notify the law enforcement, it seems, I don't know whether all the conditions of release need to be given to the law enforcement. I can understand that law enforcement may need to know some of the conditions of release that are related to perhaps curfews or other information that, you know, special curfews, like if the youth has a special curfew of, say, 7 p.m., and a law enforcement law enforcement comes in contact with this youth at 8, that's not unusual and would not spark any interest. But if it is, but the youth would be in violation of their condition of release. So certainly that would be something that is not private information, but could be information that's given to law enforcement for the purpose of helping law enforcement, helping OIA monitor these youth, which is my assumption of what the bill is trying to get to, is so there's more of a partnership between these state agencies and law enforcement. So certainly I think you can narrow, say, instead of all conditions of release, maybe conditions of release in which there needs to be monitoring by law enforcement, which would not be going to mental health treatment or taking psychotropic medication or anything like that. So I think you could narrow it a little bit more. That's the only, and I guess the only other question is, it's not really in section 5, which is on page 5, lines 20 through 23, when we're talking about the court notifying, certainly, you know, kids have to move where their parents move, and I can certainly see a situation where the court notifies the police when the youth is originally put on probation and they're living within, say, Portland. Let's say the family then moves out to Eastern Oregon and the court doesn't really know that that happens because a transfer between one juvenile department and another juvenile department happens and the court does not really get notified of that. It seems to me at that point nobody's really notifying the folks out in Eastern Oregon that this kid is coming there if it's the court that's doing the notification. Perhaps the better way to do that would be having the juvenile department do the notification, because the juvenile department would then know about such moves, because they would not only have to approve them, but they have to work out the courtesy supervision within within the different counties. So as the bill is written at this point, Juvenile Rights Project would be opposed to it. I am concerned about some of the being overbroad, but I think if the idea is to get a better partnership for these youth, there is a way to do it. The other concern that I would have is it requires this to happen on all juvenile sex offenders. Certainly what we're finding is juvenile sex offenders have different levels of risk, and what we also find is that juvenile sex offenders, what the research is showing is once they go through treatment, they're actually their rate of reoffending or likelihood to reoffend is actually pretty low. If they go successfully through treatment and they have and they're successful in that. Certainly, when youth are put on probation for sex offenses in Multnomah County, usually the probation lasts between 2 and 3 years. It can be extended if there needs to be that for additional treatment or additional reasons. The youth can finish treatment prior to the end of that and can be at that point maybe considered a much lower risk. And I'm questioning about whether we need to then give out that information as broadly as we need to.
Mr. Chair. Senator. Kathy, if that youth has not reoffended, gone through all the treatment, do they still register for the rest of their life as a sex offender?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, yes, that's currently the law here in Oregon, is that juveniles register for the rest of their life. It's lifetime registration for juveniles here in Oregon. And that's as a result of Senate Bill 740 last session, that was passed last session.
All right. We just kind of for the committee and those people interested, on the 3rd of April, we're going to have a bill that deals with a sunset in the current sex offender registration laws, but we're going to have a more expansive discussion about sex offender registration and what it should or shouldn't look like, kind of in the context of the existing budget scenario. The governor's office did not, when they wrote the budget, fund about $400,000 hole in the sex offender registration unit, and to my knowledge, that hasn't been accommodating so far. So we're going to start dealing with some of these problems. And one of the reasons I'm getting some of these issues brought before the committee is that I'm hoping to have one bill, State of Sex Offender Registration, either can incorporate some of these ideas in that bill. And kind of just declare my intent at this point with juvenile sex offenders. Kathy, you can maybe speak to this, but under federal law, they're not required to be registered.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The federal law, which required us to pass Senate Bill 740 last session so that we could continue to get the burn grant money, that federal law does not require registration on the part of juveniles. I can certainly make available to the council, not every state in the union also requires registration for juveniles, and there's a lot of different types of ways that juveniles are required to register in some states. Some states don't require them to register at all. Oregon requires, not only requires registration, but has lifetime registration.
And we're going to, again, kind of addressing the comments of the committee, we're going to get into some discussion about some of the knowledge that exists relevant to the therapeutic efficacy, I guess, in dealing with juveniles as opposed to adults, as it applies to juvenile sex offenders. It's going to be my intent to look towards changing the law so that juvenile sex offenders, juveniles, are not required to register for life, except in places where a judge finds, based on the information that they have in front of them, the case, psychological profile, whatever information available to them, that registration for life is necessary, and allow a judge to do that. And part of what's going to come out, I think, in the discussion is the fact that when it gets to adult sex offenders, we know that there are certain types of psychological instruments that are available for testing that can indicate kind of a seriousness of or dangerousness of the individual, which is where we get to how that happens. And we're going to get to talk a little bit more about how we designate individuals predatory sex offenders. We're going to talk a little bit about whether or not we should be posting sex offenders on the internet, and if so, what kind of sex offenders should be posted on the internet. Full divergent group of peoples and interests and opinions about all of that. So kind of giving you kind of a lay of the land right now. Now, if we don't pass Senate Bill 370, which is a reauthorization, all of the sex offender registration in the state of Oregon goes away. And if that happens, we lose $2 point some odd million in burn grant money, if I'm not mistaken. There's a reason to pass it. So part of it will be, you know, crafting a bill that kind of meets the direction that we want to go, or think we should be going, or going back to just the bare bones requirements to receive the burn grant. Anyway, it's going to be a broad, interesting discussion, I hope.
I look forward to it, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Karen, do you have something to say here?
I have virtually nothing to add.
That's it? Come on. Now we're about to find out what virtually nothing is.
Karen Brazeau, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. The Youth Authority's concerns have largely been stated by Ms. Osborne. Our concern about this bill is that it is overly broad. We believe that there are juvenile offenders who pose a danger to public safety, who should be tracked, but we believe that they are the juvenile offender who by virtue of age does not get caught up in the Measure 11 net. And I will give you an example of that. The 12-year-old boy, for example, who forcibly rapes the 3-year-old girl, as opposed to the 12-year-old boy who inappropriately touches the 12-year-old girl, two very different kids, need to be treated differently. And under this bill and the existing other sex offender, juvenile sex offender bills in the state are treated exactly the same. And we just think it's time that we kind of try to sort out the differences between those two kids. And our opposition to this bill is that it treats them exactly the same and treats them just like all adult offenders.
Yes, I do. Reluctant to get into any questions because some of the calls and things that are happening in my life in this whole area, but let me understand something, Karen. I had a problem session, last session, where a young man was local high school. And I notice here on existing law, I believe, that you're supposed to notify a school district if a young offender is going into that school district after you release them. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, is that in all cases or just some cases?
That is in all cases.
And when you notify the school district, those are words, you just notify a single person in the district, and then the district makes a decision, is that how it works, as to who in the school or whether they're notified or not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, when that legislation was passed, I personally had put into the legislation that we would notify the superintendent. My concern was that without having a person in the school district, we would not know who to notify, and we needed to have a point of contact. So the letters that we send are always sent to the superintendent, and that was discussed in the committee when that bill was passed. So the letters that we send do go to the school superintendent.
No, you mean the superintendent of the school district?
Yes.
Not to the principal or the vice principal?
No, to the superintendent of the school district. And I know there are problems with that.
But what's happened, in case you want to know, is I had a teacher call me. I think she taught history, but she's involved with plays at this high school, big high school here. There was a person, boy in her class, who was in the plays, who was strict prohibition in terms of socializing after hours with female students as well as younger children. Part of her deal was they should go over to one of the kids' house and meet, you know, to talk about the play and everything, and she allowed the kid to go, the kids in the play. And the girl's house, she had younger brothers and sisters, so she's walking right into it with this young man, not knowing that he's a sex offender. So we had a situation develop like that. But then the question is, how far do you go in sending out the word? It's a very difficult issue because here's a teacher on an everyday basis dealing with this young man in class plays, which in itself gets interesting as to whether or not he should have been allowed to be in class plays given the fact that, you know, the way that developed. And I don't know how you deal with that. That's why and I don't know, I'm being very delicate here because to tell a superintendent of Salem Kaiser School that this individual is going into your district, and then you got, you know, it gets very interesting. So I don't know, we don't want to micromanage, but it's a very interesting issue. And it was a real case because truly he was, it could have been really bad if he started, I guess it's the things he did sort of tip her off, something might be right, wrong. But it gets...
Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, it's something that we have struggled with forever. Prior to the law, we notified school districts in various ways and sometimes not at all. Sometimes how it happened was one of our parole officers who happened to have a relationship with the student's counselor would tell the student's counselor, who may or may not have told anyone else in the school district, or they may have told the principal who may or may not have told anyone else. So I was adamant that we would notify the superintendent. We had to have a point of responsibility who then could choose who needed to know. It still is not working the way it should work.
And I don't know how it ever, it's difficult, because you may have that young man, young woman, who really isn't a threat, and you don't want to ruin their life either. That's what makes it so hard, and I just think it's very nebulous, and I don't know if we can resolve it in law either, Mr. Chair, to tell you the truth. It's almost an impossible situation to deal with successfully.
Mr. Chair?
Questioner.
You know, I agree with Mr. Senator Courtney. It is a very difficult one, but I concur with your decision, because I think the superintendent of schools ultimately has to know in the district. I mean, I would, as a superintendent, be very upset if I heard that one of my counselors had been informed, and as a district, we didn't know, because that's the responsibility. You're at the mercy of the personalities. And as long as we deal with humans, we'll probably always have that particular problem. You know, some superintendents are going to handle it well, and I can think of some superintendents who could really mess it up. But
I mean, my hope is they would delegate it to the principal who would know in that school who should know.
Yeah, That would be the logical way, I would think.
Karen, can you chat with us a bit about some of the research or the absence of research with respect to identification of the dangerousness of juvenile sex offenders? Just in general terms, hopefully we'll have a more comprehensive presentation, but I think it's important for the committee to know, because right now every juvenile who is a quote-unquote sex offender gets this lifetime registration. But the law is pretty well blind to, again, the circumstance, whether it was some exploratory sexual touching that occurred that a clinician might look at and say, this person is not involved in pathological sexual deviance, whereas you may have someone else who clearly is involved in some kind of pathological sexual deviance that is, in fact, predatory in nature. But the law is blind to all of that. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, while the research is established in the very fact that juvenile sex offenders are juveniles, and so they are establishing their sexuality first and foremost, and so a lot of their behavior rests in the fact that they are adolescents, and making decisions right and left about a lot of things, including their sexual behaviors, and some of them don't make very good behaviors, and that their lifestyles and life decisions are not fully established and set in concrete the way adults are in general. So they are different than adults in that sense. And also what's spoken of as recidivism, and though you have to read the literature to know how the definition of recidivism, because it's measured differently in every single study you'll ever read. But generally speaking, the recidivism rates, or the rate of reoffending for juvenile sex offenders, is remarkably low after treatment. And that's the same with the Oregon Youth Authority. The reoffense rate, which I can't quote you off the top of my head, but for reoffense rate for sex offenders is lower than for the general population. However, there are those who commit sex offenses who go on to commit more sex offenses, and the problem that the state of Oregon has right now is one that is shared by the rest of the country, is that there is not an instrument that has been standardized for juveniles, meaning it's been tested for reliability, meaning it's shown to be predictable over populations of juveniles to predict those youth that will in fact go on to commit additional sex crimes. There's a couple of researchers in the country that are working on an instrument to do that. We have been working with a professor at Portland State, Dr. Kaufman, who is working with these other individuals on trying to help with the standardization effort on that instrument. But the truth is, in fact, there isn't one in the country right now. People have used different kinds of checklists that make some kind of logical sense. I mean, you would think it makes sense rationally to think that a person who tortured animals and sexually abused animals and sexually abused young people is a scary person and somebody to watch. But the scientific fact is it hasn't been standardized and probably wouldn't hold up in a court as a long-term tool to predict long-term behaviors. What Oregon has done instead is said, since we can't tease out that small group of young people that we can predict are going to go on and commit serious crimes, instead we're going to register them all for life.
Okay. So kind of for the committee, if you've had your fill of some of this, let me know, because some of this can kind of go on and on and on and on. But so give me at some point some sign as to what you're talking about.
I would also like to add that even with the small group of offenders who are dangerous and will probably always be dangerous, even that group are manageable. They're not curable, but they are manageable if properly supervised, meaning they are held accountable with polygraphs and made to walk a pretty tight and narrow line.
The seismographs or something, I forget how to pronounce that.
You know, polygraphs work wonders with people, too, of just very close supervision and monitoring and consequences when they begin to fall off of that narrow line.
Okay, so 2nd of April, more about sex offenders.
Chair?
Mr. Meyer.
One thing I didn't, and I realize this bill is not, you know, going anywhere, but final page, page 6, lines 27 through 31, it just struck me that we have to put in the statute to allow law enforcement people to release, to arrest sex offenders who, when they have probable cause, believe they've offended and violated parole. I would have thought that anyone that, if you have probable cause that they violated parole, can't you arrest people?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Beyer, an officer can have probable cause to believe you've committed a crime, and that's the basis for an arrest. So a violation of supervision is not a crime. Now, that's not to say a parole officer or probation officer can get a warrant to arrest, but that's a different situation than a regular peace officer.
Now, oftentimes the way it works is if I arrest someone and lodge them and I find out that they're on parole, I can get a hold of the parole officer, contact them, and then they'll put a detainer on the person, a parole detainer. But then all of that shifts over to the parole officer in terms of their adjudicating that. Karen, thank you very much. Appreciate
the time. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just thinking that how careful you have to be when you report. I can remember a situation where a principal, a kid went back to school, and the principal's opening comments were, listen, I know all about you, and listen, one step out of line. You know, the kid didn't have a chance in the very beginning, so you can set that stage wrong, too. It's really tough.
I mean, actually, it's interesting to me because there's a huge amount of paranoia about this whole issue.
Oh, yeah.
And so when you think about it in terms of public policy, whether this legislature or other legislatures have reacted appropriately, I don't think anybody really knows for sure. Most are siding on a side of caution, but hopefully we'll have some good presentations on some of the research and try to make some better decisions if we can and tie it all together. Okay, enough of that. Ingrid, do you have any comments on this bill, or just kind of hear watch this wonderful committee in action? Okay. Now, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 663, Senate Bill 661, 663. There's no one signed up. This is actually a bill that I introduced in the governor's office, and I've had a few conversations with Chip Lazenby about this bill and others like it, dealing with extraditions and when do you extradite individuals. And the origin of the bill actually comes from some of my work in the police bureau, where our missing persons detective in the Portland Police Bureau located a child, actually two instances within a short proximity of time, who had been abducted by a parent, and we have some dash one amendments, but abducted by a parent, taken out of the state, otherwise a custodial interference case. That person was then arrested on a custodial interference arrest warrant in fact, both cases in New Orleans, Louisiana. The New Orleans, Louisiana Police Department lodged this person, or people actually, in two different cases, in jail. And then the officer sought to have the defendant extradited from New Orleans. And in both instances, the governor's office was responsible for extraditions, declined to have these people extradited back. And so it appeared to me on the surface that when you have custodial interference cases and individuals have abducted their own children, they're subsequently arrested, that it's not necessarily good public policy to not pursue child abductions out of the state. So I'm just going to open it with that. You have a comment from Steve Marks from the governor's office with respect to potential fiscal impact on this bill, and then also some of the other, I guess, unintended consequences or potential unintended consequences. So with that, I'll just drop it. Nobody signed up to speak against this. The governor's office is not here to So I'll just open that as a kind of a point of discussion in the future, is whether or not we should or should not extradite certain sex offenders. Senator Harper.
Your description, Mr. Chair, and what I read, particularly from the governor's letter, they don't sound like the same bill.
With the dash one amendments, or
does that take care of some of their objections?
Probably not.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, to clarify, the bill as written originally relates only to those who are charged with a sex crime or have escaped or have broken supervision for a sex crime. The dash one amendment is what the Chair is mentioning as far as custodial interference, which would be applicable if a parent who does not have custody takes a child out of state. So that's why Mr. Marks's letter does not address the dash one amendment.
Right. So you really have two different things. My request initially was to deal with extradition of sex offenders and public policy questions, whether you should or should not go after individuals who are sex offenders who've left the state, whether we should mandate it. And then, again, the origin of this came out of the custodial interference cases. So it relates to extradition. That's why the related clause is nice and broad. So. Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 663, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 166. And everybody remembers this. This is the animal bill.
Well, this is, Mr. Chair, this is one of the animal. We've had three animal bills. This is the one. The big part of this bill was the cause of action that could accrue to an individual if their animal, pet animal, was intentionally killed as a result of gross or intentional actions. And anyway, there are significant amendments. I believe they're the dash two amendments, Mr. Chair, and I know High Council Adele is here to describe. I might also add, this was the one that the Chair asked myself and Senator Byer to get to see if we could get together on. And so we did it, and these amendments hopefully deal with issues that concern people, because I believe the good senator and I are together on these amendments at this time. Anyway, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make that statement.
All right. And you and Senator Byer work together.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer.
I don't know if you want to move the amendment first, but I just would want to make sure, not being an attorney, so either Senator Courtney or Marilyn, what comes to mind with this bill is that in Washington County, I believe, sometime in the last year, there was a dog that viciously bit someone, and the county there said that because of the changes were made to the statutes in the 99 legislature, they had no authority to do anything about it anymore. And I didn't recall doing that in 99, but I do know we changed the laws, and I guess my question would be, is if the changes we've made here now with the dash two amendments, if they will fix that issue concerning local jurisdictions to take care of bad dogs. I don't know if they can answer that question or not, but
I don't know if I can answer that question.
I understand it wasn't part of the bill, but the bill, and when you get down to the new Section 8 on page 6, we're talking about the disposition of dogs that have done bad things, and I don't know what the changes, if they will do that or not. I don't know if they can answer that here. But.
Well, as I recall, a dog that bites a person, one of the possible dispositions of the dog is an order that the dog be killed. Is that what you were referring to, that there wasn't the option to do that, or?
Well, that's what my confusion was, Mr. Chair, that and it seemed like from what we had done in 99 when we changed these statutes was that if counties hadn't taken some sort of an action to change their ordinances or do something, that their hands were tied and they could do nothing. And Washington County hadn't, and maybe it's all fixed now. I don't know if there's anybody here that can talk about it, but that was a concern I had, and I know I apologize, Senator Courtney, I didn't mention this when we were talking about this issue, but it came to my mind after we were kind of finished working on it. But I support the dash two amendments. I think they make the bill better. I think it'll help. But I
want everybody to understand that we had some confusion on what a bite is. We had a confusion on rabies when it should have been inoculation or not, and then we had an issue on whether or not it should be a cause of action should be created in Oregon for the intentional killing of a person's pet. And I can't, you may be asking, Senator Beyer, for something in extension of what we have here, because I think we have the bite clarified on page 2, I believe, under High Council, on section, I'm reading from the, not from the amendments, but I'm reading from the Hand and Gross bill, Mr. Chair, on lines 10, 11, I believe, Mr. Chair, Learned High Council, we talk about what we mean by a bite now, because you know what I mean? There was some any bite versus a bite for purposes of dealing with an animal in a way that you could destroy the animal. That's clarified. Then the rabies situation, I just want to talk about the amendments. The rabies situation was, where is that, Learned High Council?
Section 2.
Page 2.
Page 2, right under the one you talked about.
All right. There was an attempt there to straighten out this whole rabies confusion, which this is good law, by the way. Both these are good law. Regardless, this isn't where we get into an animal rights versus non-animal rights fight at all. This needs to be clarified in law. I really think I can say that, and this therefore these are good amendments. The cause of action, Mr. Chair, as you'll notice in your Hand and Gross bill, Mr. Chair, on the first page, has been removed. But not that issue is that's not here, and. So I don't know what to say to Senator Beyer. I don't know. As to my knowledge, the person in the room who are here now, that I don't know.
What's the question again? I just want to be very clear.
What happened during the interim between the 99 and now, after we changed the statute to 99 dealing with dogs and how dogs bite people, and there was a work group in 99, and you know, it was a same thing, and that was kind of response to the judge from Lincoln County came over and worked on this issue. And at that time, just prior to the 99 session, there was a person in Woodburn who was killed by a dog, a young girl was killed by a dog. So they're trying to address that situation, you know, to so that they could take care of aggressive dogs and at the same time not trample on dog owners' rights. Then, just prior to the session, this, you know, sometime in, you know, July or August of last year, there was a case in Washington County where a dog attacked someone in the Washington County, as reported by the press, which I don't know, you know, that was 100% accurate, but the authorities in Washington County said, our hands are tied, we can't do anything about this dog because of the legislature changed the law. In 1999, we no longer have the authority to deal with aggressive dogs. And I apologize to Senator Courtney, I didn't bring this up when we were talking about these amendments. And it just dawned on me, you know, I guess as I was reading over today, that we're amending the same sections of the law, I think, that which is section, the new section 7 by the amendments, that it talks about how, you know, when dogs bite people, what can be done about it? And I don't know if this is going to make that better or worse. I didn't know if anybody would be able to answer that question.
Well, actually, if you go to page 4, subsection 7, it says that, I may be off base here, but it says that the keeper of a dog is not charged with violating ORS 609.095 sub 2 or 3 upon a finding that a dog has menaced or chased a person when not on the premises occupied by the keeper or has bitten the person. The dog control board or county governing body may order that the dog be killed in a humane manner. Before ordering that the dog be killed, the board or governing body shall consider the factors described in 609.093 and issue written findings on those factors. Notwithstanding 34030, the disposition order issued by the board or governing body provides that the dog be petitioned by the keeper for a writ of review must be filed no later than blah, blah, blah. So it looks to me like it's setting up some new language there and the process where there's a finding of fact before the dog is destroyed. So it looks to me like it is trying to address that, but I, again,
Well, and my confusion is, I thought that's what we'd done in 99. And according to one county anyway, we made it, we tied their hands, and I'm just hoping, and this is, you know, I'm just hoping that we've fixed that problem now, and, you know, I don't know.
Chairman, it's Senator Beyer. I did send a copy of the amendments to Washington County, to their animal control people, for review, and I didn't receive any comments back from them that they had any concerns about it. So hopefully that did address their concern.
Well, maybe we can, unless you want to hold the bill, and, okay, you can go ahead and move this, and then... Emilio, you're the guy that signed up on 661, right? Okay, so you're here, this is really a work session, but what do you want to address?
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Emilio DeBest. I'm the state public health veterinarian, and we usually deal with animal bites and rabies. One of the reasons why I'm here is because I was asked to come in and clarify any questions that anybody may have in regards to some of the issues on this bill. The first one being making animal bites reportable to and under to the county health department and under the Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 333, Division 19, that is the case. We have it's already a reportable condition, and that talks about what constitutes a bite, what needs to be done with the animal, and who the ultimate responsibility may be, such as a health officer or his designee, his or her designee. The other issue that I'm here to answer any questions about is animal rabies and antibody testing instead of the rabies vaccine. And the last one is about vaccinating dogs at 6 months of age. But I may be able to answer any other questions.
Do you know the answer to Senator Beyer's question?
What was your question again? I'm sorry.
Well, I guess my question is this, will the new language in this bill, or does it have anything to do with the fact that when a dog bites someone, you know, to allow the counties to take care of that dog and take appropriate steps. Is the language in this bill going to allow counties to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the language on the administrative rules already talks about animal bites and those being reportable to the county health office, which will investigate the animal bite, report to animal control, and allow animal control to basically decide what needs to be done with the animal based on the recommendation from the health officer, who has the ultimate responsibility. And this is in regards to public health issues on rabies. So that's how we look at the bill. Animal control works with the health officer to decide what the disposition of the animal would be after an animal bite has taken place. And that's all under Division 19 under the Oregon Administrative Rules.
Senator Courtney.
I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 166.
Okay, Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 166. Discussion?
I would suggest that Senator Beyer, I don't know whether the bill's going to get out of committee, but if it gets out today, you might, or council can talk to Washington County officials to find out if these amendments in any way cause further concern or make it a better bill or a less bill. I mean that sincerely, because it's going to take a right. I feel that you're still somewhat unsure as to whether or not we're dealing with an issue that you feel should be dealt with. And so,
yeah, I'm not even sure this bill deals with that issue. And so, no, I agree. I if we can get some clarification from Washington County, or I know Marion County, because a little girl was killed in Marion County by a dog 2 years ago. And, hopefully they've paid attention and they would, you know, be watching these proceedings and know this is happening, but...
Okay. Any further discussion? Adoption of the dash amendments. Hearing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 166 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Stonebreaker, are you happy?
I'd like to see the actual bill.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I've just seen the proposed amendment.
Oh, okay.
I see it.
Yeah, let's just, we'll recess for just a couple of minutes and take a look at it, make sure you're happy. So everybody's fine with this. All right. Any further discussion on the motion to move to the floor, bill to the floor, do best recommendation as amended? Any further discussion? Ben, who wants to carry this puppy?
I go up the hill.
You're going to go up the hill.
I introduced it. I think I should go up the hill.
You're going to be more successful. We'll
see who takes a bite out of it on the floor.
All right. Anything else to come before the committee? Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a good afternoon, Roger.